Hello and welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, S.E. Fleenor, and thank you for joining us for these flashback files. Right now, Bitches on Comics is on hiatus while we sort out some personal matters and get to work behind the scenes, making sure we can come back strong very soon. These flashback files are our opportunity to share with you some of the amazing work we've been doing over on Patreon. We're so happy to be back and so glad you've joined us. Please stick around for this flashback file where we share an episode that originally appeared on our Patreon. We would like to thank all our patrons and all our supporters who've been there for us through this whole amazing podcast. And if you haven't joined us on Patreon, you can do so at patreon.com/queerspec. On behalf of Sarah Century, Monica Estrella Negra, Kate Warner, and Supriya Saxena, I'm S.E. Fleenor, and we're so glad that you've joined us.
Hey everybody, thanks for joining me. I am your host, Sarah Century, and dare I say it, your friend. I'm here today talking with Wimoto of Black Women Are Scary, which is one of my very favorite podcasts. So this conversation is full of surprises. We talk about Xena fan fiction, we talk about Buffy, and then of course, you know, about Black Women Are Scary, which again, go check it out. It's an amazing narrative horror podcast.
I'm Wimoto Naoka. My pronouns are she, her, ella. And you can find me at Dusky Projects on Instagram and Twitter.
Black Women Are Scary is, you can find it on all the podcast networks, right?
Yes. It's everywhere you listen to podcasts. And then we're also on Instagram and Twitter at Black Women Are Scary. But everything is connected to the Dusky Project. So if you go there, you will be able to find all that you need.
What got you into horror? Because this is like, I mean, we all have totally different stories that are still somehow the same. So
yeah, I definitely share the common trope. I in speaking with a lot of the people that are horror writers or horror makers, of watching inappropriate content as a child. Like that's like a thing that we all share. And I'm like, yeah, me too. Of watching scary movies when you're a kid and just being super fascinated and watching how they were made. I was very into like, I don't know if you guys remember HBO First Look, like when you get to see how they made the thing and like how they made the Terminator head and how like his eyeball came out and how like Geiger made the thing for aliens and how does it come out of the chest. And I was like, yes, this is my jam. So I loved, you know, looking at how things work. And then I also want to give a shout out to just being an unpopular kid and spending a lot of time during recess in the library being that person and inhaling books. And of course, of those books is horror and sci-fi. Because you just read everything in the room. Yeah, so I'd like to shout out both those things. Watching scary movies too young, not having any friends, and escaping into magical worlds where, like, maybe you have powers and you're, you know, fighting demons or whatever it is that you're doing, as being part of what got me into horror.
And I don't know how old you are, but I'm 38. So I was a kid in, you know, 83 was when I was born. So I was in the era of children's movies aren't that far removed from horror, where you're kind of like, yeah, my favorite movie is Labyrinth, or like,
yeah,
you know, Return to Oz or something like that.
Yeah. It's funny to look on that now, right? Me too. And I've been, you know, as somebody who like also I make some things for young audiences and work with in, you know, arts ed, in youth education. And I do think it's interesting having that and looking at, you know, things that are made for young people and the way that that's also morphing and changing with what, or clashing with what young folks are going through. And I'm like, man, you guys could really use some Labyrinth or some Dark Crystal or some Never-Ending Story. Like, that's really kind of more your jam. And I remember I was teaching at this one middle school, and I had on a t-shirt that had the goblins from the Labyrinth, and it said, "Say your right words," which I was helping out with ELA. So I was like, this seems appropriate because I'm here to, you know, teach about literacy and things and words and writing. And anyway, so this eighth grader was like, I love that movie. And I looked at her and I was like, how do you know what this movie is? I was like, how do you even know what it is? So I wonder if these, if audience, you know, young audiences today are discovering these movies and enjoying them as much as we did for the same reasons. I mean, if you look at Stranger Things.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And like, but I mean, I had students that were watching The Walking Dead.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, it's like, that's what it is to be young these days, I think. It's especially if you were like coming of age in the pandemic. I'm not really sure Disney's gonna cut it for you anymore. I don't think that's really gonna be it for you. But I definitely enjoy those films and watch them now, and am only really starting to understand just how like dark they were, you know, that the point of them was to teach you these deep lessons about life and death and acceptance. And you know, Dark Crystal, I think, is about Buddhism at the end of the day. Like when I saw it again, I was just like, oh, they were like, as a child when I watched it, the Skeksis and the slow ones, I forget their names, the mystics coming together to make like the one being, I was like, oh, that's why everything was all messed up and thrown out of whack, because it was unbalanced, because they belong together. And then as an adult watching that, I'm like, I think that's like the basis of certain faiths in the world. Like, this is actually not a very like Christian story, which, you know, you find a lot is like the majority. Right. And so it's kind of like, this is a lot for a young person to be. Also, you know, let's do the never ending story. Artex dies. Does anybody remember this?
yes. Like, viscerally, I remember it. I have a visceral physical reaction whenever people talk about it, because it's like every kid was just like, no.
But like that movie taught you that like bad things will happen to good people.
Yeah.
Also, that's part of adventure. Like, Atreyu needed to do this. And part of that means there's going to be like some low lows and some high highs. And that's just like, if you ever want to leave your house and have anything happen to you, that's that is what's gonna happen. Like, you might have to watch your horse die in real time. And you know, and you think about that, like with everything, like The Land Before Time, like Littlefoot's mom died.
Oh man, and it's so brutal, right? Like, it's like brutal. These are all brutal deaths.
She fights to the death for her children.
she does. Yeah, that's another like devastating movie.
Yeah, but childhood. Then you persevere, you know, like then you have your friends and there was all like community, you make community, you build community, and you persevere and you get to the goal. When you look at it now as an adult, is what are the messages behind these films? And it really kind of, I think, says something about the huge chasm between generations now. If we grow up watching these movies, like it's like, what kind of adult did you expect me to be? other than people say like, oh, millennials. I guess we're millennials. I don't even know.
Yeah.
Or we're geriatric millennials. I'm not sure.
But I love that term.
I love that term too. I love how they just like slid in geriatric.
Because we all do feel that way though, right? I feel like, especially like older millennials, we've just been watching stuff go down our whole lives. It's like,
yeah, it's like we're watching all of the structures fall apart in real time. So it is kind of. Yeah, I also think that it's a unique position, because I remember when tech was like big and clunky and ugly, and I got kind of like, I went through puberty with the tech going through puberty. Now it's like all sleek and small and like airless and wireless and stuff. Like, she's arrived. But I remember when she was like big and like the font was green and
dial up.
Yeah, you had to call her and it was loud.
Yeah. And back then, I feel like, the biggest extent was message boards, but mostly I was just on there reading, like, Xena fanfic or something.
Oh, my
so
God.
It still served its purpose, but it was definitely a different world. And I often am just like, yeah, thank God that 12-year-old me did not have access to, Twitter or something.
It must be terrifying, because it's like all of my awkward ridiculousness and shenanigans is unrecorded. Like, there's no record of it. You can't even prove that I did it. So, like, and I love this. It's like plausible deniability as I move into adulthood, you know? I mean, I remember like when Facebook kind of came into its own, and I was already like an adult, like a young adult, but an adult by the time I joined that. So, you know, and even still, there's a kind of internet literacy or internet etiquette that we have yet to create. You know, as you get older, you're like, you know, these are the things that I want to do, or this is how I want to use the internet, and this is how I don't want to. This is what I'm going to allow myself to post or allow people to talk to me, or like, I'm not going to get any fights on the internet. Like, these things that you like, you know, commandments that you make for yourself as you like learn, as you construct internet etiquette for yourself, because you're a grown up. If I was 10, I don't think I'd be able to do all that. And I would just be living like an avatar / real life. Like, it would just be like a VR experience from jump. And I think that to me, I think is scary. And they don't know. They have no other concept of anything else, so they don't know to be scared. But I'm just like, yo, there's freedom in offline. I want to be like, I want to tell young people sometimes, like, offline is emancipation. like
being unconnected, because it's like now, as you said, as adults, it's very easy for us to be like, you know what, I'm just gonna not look at Twitter today. I think it's for the best. But what if your whole friend group was entirely reliant on it, and you're like a, you know, 13-year-old or something? Then it's like, you're gonna be on there all day every day, and you're gonna say stuff that is terrible because, you know, you're a teenager, something that will embarrass you later for sure.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, we don't know where this is all recorded and owned by someone, and I don't know what this data is gonna be used for. That's like the scariest thing. It's not just like we have a record of you being an idiot and I can point to it, but it's also just like, is that gonna matter when you're trying to get into college or get a job later?
Exactly.
Are they gonna look at that as like a record of something? But then there's the other side of it, finding safe spaces on the internet, you know? So if you're a queer kid in some small town somewhere, the internet could save you.
Yes. As I mentioned, the Xena fanfic.
Yes.
But because it's like, even in the beginning, it did have that potential, right? It was always something of thinking, maybe I was like 15 or 16 before I had any kind of regular access to the internet. But once I did, as weird and clunky and slow as it was still, this is everything. You know, in that time, everybody was like, Xena straight, everybody straight, like, just be straight. And it's just like,
yeah, I don't know how anybody believed this.
It's wild, right? Whenever I was a teenager, I had this like adult woman yell at me because I made like an offhand comment. And,
rewind. let me hear the whole thing. So you were a teenager and you were around some adult woman who yelled at you because you said something about Xena?
Yeah, because she loved Xena. Like, she had like a Xena t-shirt, and I was like, yeah, Xena, like, hopefully her and Gabrielle get married.
Yes.
Yeah, she was very upset that I had said that, which is funny because culturally that's the reason we all remember Xena now, but in the time,
this was so confusing to me as a child, because, you know, we had like, my parents are, they had queer friends, they were like involved in the queer community, so queer folks were just around. And that's kind of like the best thing when you're a kid, because you're just like, oh, so-and-so and his husband.
And that's, it's normal.
Like, they got me presents, and that was what mattered the most.
You're like, they are cool by me.
Right? It's like, I got this cool dress. Awesome gay guys. like, you know, it's just, that's what you're at when you're a child. So
yeah,
I remember watching Xena and never thinking anything else other than that, like, Gabrielle and her are clearly in love.
Yes, married for sure.
That they're in love, and this is a love story. and like, now I'm rewatching it with a friend, and we're like up to season 4, and there was some, you know, it's funny because she was also one of those people who were just like, they just had a deep friendship, and I was like, they're in love. I don't know. You need to watch this again. This is not a deep friendship. These women love each other. They're in love. And so we're watching it, and I'm like, you can see this now, right? Like, as we get deeper into the seasons, it just gets gayer and gayer. Like,
that's
like,
it
gets, it just like keeps it, like, there's the writers had such a good time of like actively not talking about this. Like, you could see them having fun. You could see them, these moments when they would, when someone would ask a question and they would direct Lucy Lawless and what's her name who played Gabrielle?
Renee O'Connor
to like give each other like a side look that suggests that they were like, that's how Xena got a hickey. Like there was one moment where that happened where, you know, the guy that always, what's his name? I want to say Xander.
Because he is the Xander. He's like proto Xander.
Jockster. You know, where he was like, what's that thing on your leg? Your neck, you've got a hickey or so how'd you get that? And like, Gabrielle and Lucy and Xena like actively like don't look at each other, like they look away from each other, and there's like all these like moments like that where they do that, or where they're like in a bathtub together.
Yes.
And, like, they're talking about their adventures but they're in a bathtub together. Y'all. Yes. And then there was a moment where somebody, they had a beauty competition.
Oh yeah, yep.
You know,
here she comes, Miss Amphipolis, a classic.
And there was this whole after school learning moment special about that. And I'm like, this is the mid 90s when they're doing this. Like,
yeah,
this is actually a trailblazing show. I didn't know that they did that. They were addressing these issues that people are just starting to like really even get to now. And they were already, that was like season 3 or something. And I was like, how did you get away with this? And I think it's just like the genre.
They were subtle about it enough that, like, people who didn't want to see it anyway wouldn't see it.
How could you miss it, though?
once you get into, like, season 6, it is so gay. They are married in that season. Like, there's an episode where they go to... This interview is going off of the rails right
Yeah,
now.
Now we're just talking... This is a podcast about Xena, y'all.
I've been waiting to have one. I'm so glad you're rewatching it. So there's this episode called When Fates Collide, and they meet... It's like Xena and Gabrielle meet each other in an alternate reality, and they are so into each other. Like, the second they meet, like, Xena is, like, looking in her direction off of a balcony, and everybody else, like, looks, like, kind of bored with the play or whatever, and Xena, like, throws a rose, like, applauds. Yeah. Like, there's so much. And then, like, when they talk, like, they're talking about, like, do you believe in dying for love? And, like, all of this. And I'm like,
no,
they're just married now.
It just gets so gay. Like, the musical episode, like, so many, like, there's just so much where I'm just like, they're soulmates. And then not only that, but it's like, they're these swashbuckling lesbians just like on the road, like just out there, like living their lives and having adventures. But they also kind of seem to be polyamorous. Like if Gabrielle wants to like get with a dude, or Xena wants to get with a dude, sometimes it's fine. They always just like go back to each other. Or if the dude is gonna like stick around, he has to contend with the fact that that's
their end game,
her wife. Right? You know what I mean? Like, it's like, if you get with Xena, you gotta like be cool with Gabrielle, because that's really who she's gonna go home to.
Yeah, and Gabrielle, despite, like, I think sometimes just getting into group stuff with the Amazons is, like, still always going to go back to Xena, too. So it's
I know,
like,
so it's like, even other women.
Yeah.
They're in love. And I guess the way to segue back into this is, like, because that genre, you know, horror, fantasy, like, this space is for the other. And so if you feel othered, this is where you can live. Like, nothing bad ever happened. They were never punished, I should say. Like, obviously bad things happen. So it needs to be conflict or it'd be boring TV. But Xena was never published, but it was never punished for being how she is. She was this authoritative, strong woman who lived on her own, who made, you know, questionable choices. and no one ever... didn't believe that she was strong, didn't believe that she was the best fighter. If a man ever questioned her, sometimes she wouldn't even bother to like let him interrupt her. And then the other men would be like, dude, shut up, Xena's talking.
Yeah.
And it was a world where nobody was a misogynist, or everybody was, if someone was a misogynist, people recognized it and they thought it was ridiculous, including other men.
And they were immediately shut down for it.
That, how can, again, just to tie it all in with, like, the stuff that we grew up watching, how can you have that on TV and then be surprised at what's going on right now once the then teenage girls who were watching that become women? Like, what did you expect? Like, I grew up on a show where, like, this could happen. this was the world and it was normal. So
yeah.
Why would I be okay with you like doing anything at the, in the workplace, you know?
Yeah.
Or on
yeah,
the street.
Zina would hit you in the face with a chakra, so.
Yeah, she would have just been like, eh, and like thrown it. And then you have her, and then like what, you got Alias, you got Buffy. Like,
yep.
If you think about that time and what, you know, what these women were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And why that genre is so appealing. It's, you know, you come to it because it's like a place where you feel like you can be yourself and not be, not have the consequences of both being yourself is in the real world, right? So it's like it's juxtaposed with your reality. Like I remember that, just bringing it full circle of just not having any friends in school. You know, it's like the reality is if you are a smart, outspoken young woman of color, no one celebrates that. Like no one's, people are definitely going to interrupt you, and everybody is going to like side with a person who is interrupting you, right? Like no one's going to acknowledge any of these things. They're going to be threatened. It's going to make you a target. And like, that's the reality. But there is a world where that makes you chosen because you're the slayer.
Yeah.
Do you know? Like that just means you're destined. That's all that means. And who wouldn't want to escape to that world?
There's always the realm of horror really helps you in a lot of ways for me. There's always so much commentary in it, like, which is, it's one of those things where people sometimes will be like, no politics in horror or something like that. And it's like, okay, like that's always been horror, like since literally Frankenstein.
Yeah. Written by, like, a woman, by the way.
Yeah. And what a wildly political text. And the fact also that people were like, she didn't write this is political. Sorry if you don't want to believe that, right? To like these guys. But it is a political thing because it's like, she's just out here trying to like invent whole genres. And like, people are just like, I think it was her husband. And it's like,
No, dude, it was her.
And there's no way Piercy sat down and wrote that book, right? Like, you know, he's a poet.
We know it was her.
But yeah, so I was thinking too that there's always so much commentary around it, but there is a lot of empowerment in horror as well. And I think people have talked that pretty much to death. But what my question was is, what about all of this translated to like storytelling and like kind of wanting to be, you know, a person who was bringing stories to people?
You know, that's a great question because I've been writing all my life, but I did not even call myself a writer until recently and didn't even take myself seriously as a writer until, I don't know, like the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going back to being the nerdy kid in the library reading all the books, and then I was writing poetry, of course, because as any melancholy, thoughtful girl does. And eventually I started writing horror stories of my own. This is like in middle school I'm writing vampire stories.
Yes.
And things like that. And one of which I actually have recently adapted and upgraded. It's not a vampire story, but one of the horror stories that I wrote as a child, I was like, you know what, this actually has some legs. And I took it and I was like, let's revamp this. And I've kind of like modified it. I'm now shopping it around to get it published because I'm like, let's do the like adult version of this. So some of the ideas were good is what I'm saying. Writing was just kind of like this escape, but I just didn't see myself as a writer. I was a performer at the time. And I went to, like, you know, performing arts high school, and I danced and I sang and did theater. And then my BFA was in musical theater. So the writing has taken many different turns, but it has always been a constant. I never named it. So I was writing these short stories, and then I remember writing like a short skit one time, but it was a classroom assignment. And everybody like laughed and I was like, oh, this is crazy. But I just kind of like was like, but you know, I dance. You know, it's just one of these things where you like cast yourself in a role for whatever reason as a child. And you're like, that's who I am. but writing was just kind of like there in the backbone. There were times when we would have to do like writing exercises to, you know, to like get to like some acting thing. And then I would write the thing and I would perform it. And some people would be like, you wrote that just now? Like, I was like, yeah. Didn't take it seriously. Eventually moved into writing music. So for a while I was just like in a band and I was writing lyrics and that was what I was writing. And then from there somehow circled back to theater, to writing theater. So a lot of it really came from like, I want to make work for myself because, you know, they tell you in school, like, know your type, but there was no type like me. It was some homogenous music theater up until recently has been, and in many ways it's still very homogenous theater.
Right.
America is very homogenous. Media is homogenous. We're all aware of the discussions about, you know, representation mattering. So like, if you're in that class and you're one of the like three or whatever, you know, or there's like five of you, or maybe there's five of you and like, good on you. But you look at this overwhelmingly, like the types are, you know, Eurocentric. And they're also like, even in that representation, they're super narrow. You know, we're not talking about like body diversity either.
Right.
And any of that. So, you know, writing was just kind of like, well, I got to make work for myself. And that was really how it started. Like, I need to make work for myself. So I'll write it. And then I started like, well, let me make work for me and my friends. So it actually kind of wasn't about like, I need to tell this story. It was like, I want to make work. You know, I want to have stuff to be in. And then it's kind of like, once you do it, like once I did it and it was like, outside of me, like I came up with a story, I needed these people to be in it to tell this story, and then I made it happen and I got to sit and see it, or sit and see other people see it. Like once that happens, you feel kind of like a wizard. You're like, this is magic. I just made this happen. All these people are saying these words that I made this up. And they all like went on ahead and said yes to my cockamamie idea here, and they're committing to it. And you know, I just felt so humbled. Every time anybody says yes to anything I'm doing, I'm always so humbled, because it's just like, who am I to tell you to do any of these things? And you're committing to this fantasy world that I've made up, and good on you. But it does feel like a kind of sorcery. And once that happened, I was like not really able to turn away anymore from storytelling. Like then it just kind of like imprinted itself, and it's like, oof, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to stop doing this. This is amazing. This is so yeah. much more amazing than like when people hand me something and I get to like perform their thing. Like what? This is magical. Look what I did. So that's, I guess, how it came to it.
I have a kind of a strangely similar background. I wasn't music theater, but I did be in a band and did one-off like one-woman performance shows and stuff nice. Like that that were Good all times. Kind of jokes, like basically just humor oriented. And I did a bunch of that, and then it was definitely like I started doing criticism, but after that I've danced around every single thing, right? And like I would do lyrics that I would I would watch like an old classic movie or something. And then I would write lyrics from one of the characters' perspective or something like that. So I'd always be trying to, because I didn't want to always just be writing my own thoughts after a while. So it was very much that, where it was just like, it started to like appeal to me in this very like roundabout way. And literally only in like the last 5 years would I be like, yeah, I'm a fiction writer. Like now that I've been published like 15 or 20 times, I feel like I can say it. But also whenever you like write a script and people like actually act it out, that is literally the most fun thing in the world. So I just want to concur with that. My next question would be, there's so many, whenever it comes to horror, like mediums, right? There's so many. There's so many different ways to listen to horror or to read horror, just to ingest horror. Like, and it's the same as anything else. But I think that horror really specializes and has for such a long time because it has like this really long history. Like you have like the old Lights Out show and stuff like that. So I was curious, did you feel whenever you were starting this podcast, like grounded in that in any way? Like, did you listen to like any of the old school stuff? Are you listening to podcasts now that are horror? And I guess, why was it so important to do this as a podcast specifically?
Well, initially, actually, it was going to be dinner parties. And I know that. So bear with me now. We were going to read the stories live at a dinner party. So we would intentionally invite people over being like, we're going to read these stories and we're going to talk. We're going to tell you a scary story and we're going to talk about it over food. And we were going to record that party. And that was going to be the podcast. So it would be both this like live experience and this recorded experience. Like you could listen to it and be like you were at the dinner party, but then also the dinner party would move, you know, it would happen monthly and it would be like in different, at the time I was living in New York, so it would be in different boroughs. And then we thought like, you know, maybe eventually we'll do it like in different cities. And you can like be like volunteer, say like, I want to host this dinner party. So it was both like, do you know about this author? Let's talk about it. Let's like, but also just the like juiciness of like sitting around and being like, I'm going to tell you a scary story. Yes. You know, like which I think, and I don't, I mean, this might be like gender specific, but like that was like the thing you did when you had sleepovers. That's what it's, why you go over to somebody's house. So that you guys can tell each other scary stories and freak each other out. So there's just this glee and joy of that. And just being able to talk about like, you know, hey, the things in this story. So it was going to be that, really about getting people together to tell stories in the most like basic of ways in this like simulated almost campfire type of experience via dinner party. Then the entire world shut down. So we were all set up to have our first dinner party in March of 2020. Guess what happened? So then we were like, okay, this isn't going to happen. And we really kind of thought, should we even do this? Should this even happen at all? Then I said, I guess it's going to be a podcast. And if it's going to be a podcast, then we're going to fully produce these stories. And at that time I was listening to LeVar Burton Reads.
Oh, yeah. And I love that.
I loved it, you know? And so when the podcast idea happened, because I can't say that it was in a vacuum. Like, it had a lot to do with the pandemic. But, and, you know, I had started a podcast group, which is funny. So in terms of what you're saying, like, am I listening to podcasts? I'm listening to all kinds. My podcast group is basically like a book club where, like, for podcasts. So we get together biweekly and we just recommend, like, someone will recommend a podcast in an episode and we'll listen to it and then we'll get together and talk about it. So it's a way to, like, learn about different podcasts. So I don't exclusively listen to horror podcasts.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to go back in time of like beforehand, I grew up in the Northwest, so I camped. So telling stories around a campfire and having stories, spooky stories being told to you in that way is like a part of my childhood memories, right? And then even after that, whenever I would hear audio plays or get a chance to like hear like some kind of like audio story, I really love the act of just being able to sit and listen to somebody tell me a story and not have to use my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I also think so much of horror is about what you hear and not actually about what you see. I think, and horror movies that I love are the ones where they really use sound. I mean, I think some of the greatest, you know, the great horror makers are folks that also like soundtracked or thought about the sound in their films. Because what you hear is so important to the genre.
Yeah, I think horror soundtracks, I listen to them on playlists all of the time because they're so good. There's so few bad horror soundtracks in this world. They're always spooky. They are always super atmospheric. There's tons of cool synth music on horror soundtracks. Tangerine Dream did Near Dark. You know, it's like all of these people who are top of their game kind of do these amazing horror movie soundtracks, and that dates back all the way to the beginning where you're like, wait, this composer did like
yeah people are composing. I mean, like, I have like the soundtrack to Bram, you know, the 1990s Bram Stoker's Dracula. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
Annie Lennox is on it. There's like a surprise song at the end by Annie. I was like, she was on this thing, you know. And then recently Candyman, the art that's a part of that film, as well as the sound, is, you know, it's all very intentional and is a part of the entire interaction and engagement with the film. So it doesn't really, it might start with the movie, but it doesn't stop there. So I just kind of feel, I don't even remember what your question was, but I think it was about like why audio. And it's just like, cause sound is just such a key part of freaking people out.
Oh yeah, right? Because it's always one of those things. And I agree, and I think that it is across mediums as well. Like, I believe that it's true in film. I believe that it's even true if you're just reading a book, because, you know, like, the setting matters to how much enjoyment you're getting out of it and how scary it is a lot of the time. Like, where I'm sitting in my apartment, what time of day, you know, all of those things definitely add to the experience. So I think that horror is very dependent on sound in a lot of ways. And yeah, it's just interesting to think about, because that might be why there's such like a big, long history of it, right? And like, yeah. so many podcasts or like even old time radio shows that were just like, you know, I mean, back then, I guess, like for radio, it was kind of the top of the line stuff. You know, you had those whole studios that were just about making sounds and stuff. So that stuff is so fun. I think it's so, so cool. So I guess my next question would be, has there been something with the pod that you haven't had a chance to do yet that you would like to get into more? Because, I mean, the dinner party idea sounds really cool. But
yeah, I would like to revisit our initial idea of doing that. Yeah. when being in person isn't so dire.
Yeah.
I still think that, like, that was like a solid thing that could happen in addition to what we're doing right now. I'm also, you know, we have these macabre mixers, and I'm curious, like, how would it feel to do those in person as well? Or, like, can they only really exist virtually? So there's, like, some experimenting once things get safer, what we could do, how we could tell people stories in person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that really has struck me about podcasts in general is that, you know, people get so committed, and then these podcasters tour. And I actually went to a live podcast recording with a friend of mine for a podcast that she really loves. And I remember the line was wrapped around the block, and I was like, this is like a rock concert, you know? And this is for just the people who had tickets. So then we get in there and we get seated, and these guys like come in and they sit down at a, you know, behind a table, and they're really just doing their podcast like in front of you.
Yeah.
And there's some visuals going on behind them, so they incorporated some projections. But ultimately I was like, this place is packed because they just want somebody to tell them a good story.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's so primal, this idea of just sitting down, nothing else is really happening, and someone is just actively telling you a good story. I don't think we're ever, with all of our gadgets and things, ever going to move away from that. So yeah, I'm wondering moving forward, like how to expand on that and increase that. Or, you know, like just do that intentionally with the folks that have already engage with the work. And then I'm curious about episodic work too, for audio.
Yeah.
So I'm also, not that this podcast would do that, I'm just like curious, like what does that look like if one of the authors that we work with, it's like, okay, let's do a series.
Yeah.
like a little mini series. Like that's like somehow like an offshoot of a thing that's like within the realm of things that we do sometimes. Like we've got the podcast, which is like anthology, but like what would it be like to be like, and in this like kind of like TV where they have their like 4-part miniseries, blah blah blah, of so like a, you know, a story that's just longer, it just takes longer to tell. And could we pull something like that off where you're like investing in characters for a couple of episodes?
Yeah.
So I wonder about that. I've listened to some podcasts that do that. They're great. And it's a very different way to experience an episodic storytelling when it's all audio, and the kind of like bells and whistles they put around it, like companion episodes to, depending on like what the story is about. I just think that that's really interesting. And I wonder about doing that, and I wonder, like, does anybody like that?
Oh yeah.
Is it just me? Like, is it like 5 nerds who are just like, I really like it when you tell me episodic, and everybody else is like, oh my god, why would I do that when I could watch TV? But there was things about, in particular, this one I heard, which was Forest 404, which was a sci-fi. It was an eco thriller. It's like maybe like 8 episodes long. You know, so it's not like really. It's not like it's gonna take your whole life. But because it was an eco thriller, they would have these episodes, like each episode was like 20 minutes, and then afterwards they have like little mini ones that were just about like the science that was a part of this, you know. And that was easy too, and it was all like about sound and the role of sound, and then you had like things that you could like tests that you could take about it stuff like that. So it's kind of like nerdy in that way too. But I was like, this is really great. I would never have thought of this research being presented in an end, like, you know, you could interact with it in this way through this like story. So I am kind of curious about, could I do something like that? Can't like sit down and do it, but I think there's also that, you know, element of it. But I'm also just like, you know, in terms of, I did some radio play work last year for theater, and I really enjoyed, you know, I had a stage piece that I then translated for sound, for audio production. And that was like a really wonderful experience, and also challenging, of just like, how do you make this work when you can't see, you know, like you just, you realize how much you rely on people being able to see things and having these kind of like visual cues that communicate sure. things. And it's like, okay, all of that is stripped away. So how are you going to do this sonically? So there's also that as well, just the aspect of like telling one, a long story in parts sonically and having it make sense, as opposed to like when you just have the one-off and you know that like we just need to do this in this container.
Listening to audiobooks of books that I have read sometimes will give me just a completely different view of the book. Like Toni Morrison reading her own writing is like, it's like, I
can imagine. I've heard her speak before. It's, you know,
Yeah. And then it's like the way that the emphasis works, it's like, I didn't read that at all. I just read that in my voice. Yeah. So then when you hear somebody, you know, saying things in their own words, and a lot of times that'll add a lot for me, or just the way that they tell it, like that book, The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin.
Yeah.
I read it, had a great time. It was really fun. And then when you actually listen to it, the narrator goes off. Like, she is having so much fun. Like, she's super theatrical, over the top, amazing. Like, I always think that there's space for every medium. Like, I love every medium pretty much. I will read, like, I read and also listen to audiobooks, but I have less time for like sitting and reading than I do for audiobooks. So anytime I want to reread something, I'll usually like throw on the audiobook. But this is all to say, like, I am looking forward to it if you get around to it, because that sounds very fun.
Yeah, I think there's just also something special about sitting and again, just like this, being able to sit, especially as the world gets busier and busier and noisier and noisier. It is.
Oh yeah.
It starts to feel very special to listen to somebody tell you a story. And you know, back when I was like, as we all like return maybe to commuting mm-hmm. in our lives, that was like the thing everybody I knew was doing, is, you know, you listen to music, but eventually you get tired of every single song you have.
Yeah.
You're just tired of all your music, and then inevitably it's podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. I remember discovering podcasts with Stuff You Missed in History class, and it was on like a big long drive, and I was like, all right, here we go.
Yeah, yeah.
Gonna learn about history. And then after that, totally sold on it. Also, audiobooks, let's face it, have gotten a lot better. I remember back in the day, like, they were always just a monotone British guy, like, for no matter what it was. It'd be like whatever book, and only the most famous books would actually get it, right? Get like the audio adaptation. So
yeah, I heard that there's like some little like, some folks who listen to audiobooks, they even have like favorite narrators.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. Or I'll start to recognize like the narrators who are doing more than one book. I mean, when you're doing a lot of curation, I'm sure that the answer to this question is pretty much like, I love the stuff that I'm choosing to put out. But is there anything that's standing out to you as far as horror goes these days? Is there something that has recently just blown your mind? Obviously, feel free to plug anybody on, you know, that you know, but also, has there just been something, a movie, you know, podcast, anything that stood out to you over the last few months?
When it comes to curating, I actually have a little story committee, and I really rely on those folks. So I wanted to ensure that the podcast wasn't just like stuff I like and like and that's it, like it's just like kind of the like backhanded Wimoto show. Like I was like no, I want as many different kinds of writing, and so I need to have other people looking at this, and it can't just be about like my likes and dislikes, like who cares. So I guess in terms of anything that's standing out for me in doing this is just the sheer volume of BIPOC writers that are not getting their due. Like, that really is it to me. As I get more into like, okay, who's in what anthology and who like what, and what is this anthology? And oh, I need to like just like the recruit, like finding the recruiting of authors and finding stories and all of that. But then like going down that rabbit hole, sometimes when I'm reading now, I'm really reading to like, to decide, I'm like, I think I want to give this to the story committee to read. Like, that's actually what I'm doing. And so it's just keeping up with the amount of work that is available, that has been out, that has been published, and really just like didn't get its due.
Yeah.
And then trying to get a hold of those people. You know, but I think that that's like the thing. It's just like, you know, folks say, oh, there's more like inclusivity in horror now, and we see more diversity, and it's just kind of like, that's not what's happening. It's these folks who've been making incredible work and not really receiving any support, and now that's starting to happen, but they're 10, 20 years in, and like right. three novels later. So it's right. not, it's new to you, but like this book has been around for, you know, however many times, and was like taught at blah, blah, blah universities, and now it's just now being adapted because, you know, so that to me is the thing that is really standing out to me, is just, you know, I started a big part of just doing the work that I do is like, I wanted to find my tribe. I wanted to find other people like me. And boy, did I get my wish. Like, I have. I thought we were in a minority, but that's not what it feels like. Or that's not mm-hmm. what it's looking like now. I'm like, oh no, there's a lot of, you know, people of color working in genre spaces. So then I start to really think like, so why did it feel like it wasn't?
Yeah, because all of the time, it's like, I mean, there's people where to me, I'm like, this person is like a megastar. Like, I think about like Nalo Hawkinson or something, right? And I'm like, that is the most famous writer in the world, right? And like, people are like, who? I'm yeah. just like, wow.
Or like, even Octavia Butler, like when she finally right. made the New York Times bestseller like 30 years right. ago, she died. And I was like, yeah. You know that she was like, she's been dope for like a minute though. And people were like, oh yeah. my God, Parable of the South, you know, like, and it was prophetic. And I was like, that book was published like 20 something. I'm just like, this is not, y'all are kind of late, you know, like,
yeah.
So that's the thing that's really struck me, is that I thought I was really going to have to be like searching through things. And that maybe was the case for like 5 minutes. And then it was like, oh, I'm overwhelmed. It's the opposite. And so I often reflect on that of like, well, you are not alone. But then I am also like, so then why did it feel that way? Like, what was going
right.
on? What's going on here?
Because it's like only just now people are like, oh, Jewel Gomez is good or yeah. something. And it's like, okay.
that was like a while ago.
That was a minute ago. But once again, nobody was recognizing it. Like, it was one of those things where like 100% people were just like, oh, that was for a YA audience or something, like people being like super dismissive. And then, you know, years pass and people are like, oh, I think that person might have been a genius this whole time.
And yeah, it's like, yeah. And I wonder about that. Like, I wonder about like the things that are now coming into the forefront. Like, yeah. what is it about now that is allowing for that to happen that wasn't happening before? Like, why are we all so ready now?
Yeah, because there's always been a push. That's something too that you find out is like, because I remember listening pretty recently to You Must Remember This did a mini season on Song of the South, and like whenever they were talking about it, they were like, no, this isn't like offensive today, this is offensive in the time. Like, everybody was mad about this back then. Or like when you talk about like almost anything, it's like there's always been a push against it. So people will be like, oh, back then we didn't really care about that or something like that, or like back in my day we didn't, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. political correctness didn't matter to me or something like that. And it's like, but it did matter to a lot of people.
Yeah, like, right,
so it's
right.
like, it is interesting to be like, oh, so now we have to, it's like we're being a lot more. And honestly, maybe it's just as simple as like having more internet access. It didn't level the playing field by any stretch of the imagination, but it definitely made things to where it's like, if somebody puts out a movie that's like transphobic, we hear about it immediately, right? So yeah. it's like,
yeah.
And to better or worse too, because sometimes right. that gives it more power than it needs. Like, there's times where I'm like, you didn't need to boost that. Like, don't. Yeah. But yeah, something along those lines, maybe.
Yeah, I do think that the placement of internet and that you know, the internet is a real place. Our avatars are a part of us. The singularity has happened, in my opinion. The singularity has come and gone. So we're actually like post it right now. And so I think that might also have something to do with just like having access to ideas and content from other places and other perspectives, and then having access to it, and then that access becoming an appetite for it. Right? Yeah. Like now, like seeing a genre work from other countries on Netflix is like, if they didn't do that, you'd be like, what's wrong with you, Netflix? Like, I want to see the biggest horror film out of Thailand now, yesterday. You know what I mean? Like, I want to, like, I just the things that I'm able to, like, inhale, you know, and be able to, the turnaround just being so fast, and the appetite, you know, you just want more and more. There's always, like, more. And I think then there's also just what's happening in the world, the demand for horror as people process fears. We need this genre. We need futurist work, which is why people love sci-fi, because we want projections of a future that we either can survive, or that like where we did it and we can figure out how to get there. Like, it seems all very essential to just getting through the day now. And that's another thing that has really struck me, is just how ubiquitous horror has become in the past couple of years. Like, it used to be where October was our month, and now horror movies are coming out every year, all year. There's so much. And so there's only so many times that you can watch like the classic Final Girl, some like, I don't know, waifish white girl, like run upstairs and somehow live. Like, we can only all watch that so many times before you just have to tell a different story. So I think there's also just kind of like, well, we ran out of ideas. But then there's also just like, the country has changed, right? Totally. Mm-hmm. There's just been a shift in just like the people who live here. And so you got to start telling, we need to start seeing different horrors here. And that coming into the, you know, coming into the forefront slowly but surely. But I think some of that is the push why people are like, oh, by the way, Jill Gomez, you know what I'm saying? Like, right. 'Cause they're like, right, these people have been around and we've been actively ignoring them for the longest time. And now we really need to not do that. Because we're, you know, we've run out of content.
All
this content was just sitting there.
Yeah, lots of re-releases lately, or translations. Like, I had no idea who Yoko Ogawa was, and then I read The Memory Police, which, like, I believe was written in, like, the mid-90s, and then, like, there was another one called, like, The Graveyard Apartment by a different writer. These are things that were written forever ago. They were written in, like, the early 90s, mid-90s, and it's just, like, they're just now, people are like, oh, this is really good.
Right,
it's like,
right.
But because they didn't have translations available, like, Yoko Ogawa is probably one of the most famous Japanese writers. Like, she's written like 50 plus books, but there's like 4 of them available in English. So it is part of that, but it's like the fact that people are actually making an attempt to do translations now, as opposed to it just being a very like homogenous sphere. And of course, tons of gatekeeping, right?
I think there's tons of gatekeeping, and there's also like, you know, smaller networks allowing for some dismantling of that gatekeeping on some level. Funding and access to resources is still a very like kept space.
Yeah.
And so you always have to contend with the people who have resources, even if, you know, no, regardless, like, it doesn't matter what you do, you have to contend with that. And they're going to have the folks who have obviously all the stuff are going to be like, well, I want to see stuff about this. I want to see stuff about me. I want to see stuff about you.
I want to fund some movies where Lex Luthor's actually the hero and Superman's the bad guy. My name's Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, like, what's wrong with me going into space all by yourself? exactly. Right. So you have that. But then, I think there's also just, I don't know what the psychological ramifications of being in quarantine for this amount of time is going to have on people. But I do think, like, we're going through it collectively. And we are a species that wants to connect and know each other. And we're also, like, deeply afraid of one another.
Right.
So I think we need these. We need, the way through that is to tell each other stories. And to tell each other our stories in order to know each other. I think at the end of the day, we just want to know each other. And this is the way humans actually do it and have been doing it, right? Back before there was any kind of media, you had a griot, you had a storyteller, you had a wise man. you had actors that would travel around. Like, being an actor meant you would, like, get in a caravan and travel around and, like, set up someplace and just be like, we're doing a play. And then, like, nothing else was happening in the town. And, like, it would be, there would be, like, no, like, schedule. Nobody bought tickets. You would just, like, come with your wagon or whatever the hell, set the thing up, do your play. People would just gather around because you were a spectacle in the town or the village. Yeah. And then, you know, they would give you something in return for that, and you would just go on about it. You know, like, there were these roving storytellers once upon a time. And so we relied on these folks to make us feel things, to tell us what was happening in the village next over, you know, like, that was also the news somehow. Like, you know, this was how we knew each other. This is how we were able to, like, process what was happening in the world. And I think... Mm. At the end of the day, it still is.
Yeah, because even it's like the same, right? Political dissent was like 100%. Here's my weird nursery rhyme or something like that. So yeah, I guess the more things change, right? Like, the more they stay the same. I'm going to ask one last question, which is, we know what Jeff Bezos wants to see more of, but what would you personally like to see more of whenever it comes to not just horror? I mean, any genre of fiction. Of course, this is definitely going to be attached a little bit to the last question, but is there something where you're just like, I just don't see enough of this and I want to see a lot more?
Okay, so I'm going to be very broad and then I'm going to be super specific. So yes. Broadly, I would like to see horror and sci-fi. Okay, Broadly, I'd like to see horror that centers people of color that isn't about social justice. Mm. I would like to see that more. They are shapeshifters and they're having a turf war with the other shapeshifter crew.
Yeah.
And, like, that's it. And that's it. And there's all different kinds of folks in it. And, like, that's not even the point of the movie. The point is that they're shapeshifters and they're in a crew and, like, these two people are in love and, like, or whatever it is, you know what I mean? And, like, the whole town's going to get leveled or something. And that's it. Like, that's the point of the story. So in horror, I'd like to see that. In sci-fi, I would like to see future narratives that don't just replicate things that have actually happened in the past.
Right,
so yeah. I'm really over this whole dystopian future in which it really is, like, a genocide that has occurred to a group of people now happening to white people.
Yeah.
And now it's like, now it's catastrophic. And I'm kind of like, right. But I recognize all of those, that whole story. And even the person that you're, like, playing as the hero is an actual activist somewhere that's either still alive and in jail or, like, was assassinated in front by government officials somewhere. And so it's like, it's just hard to swallow. Like, I'm just like, this isn't a future story.
Right.
This is a replication of a thing that this is therapy. Like, we're clearly not over it and we're processing it. And that's what this film is, disguised as, like, a future work. It's like, no, future work would be like if we're post all of these systems. Like, that's, show me that.
That's something that's been driving me up the wall lately, because I had to like catch up on all of The Walking Dead, and, like, always the biggest problem with it is, like, why are the cops still in charge? Like, this is wild that it's like they cannot imagine a world where there isn't a police force and there isn't a military. And it's like, well, just push it a little bit further, right? Say that, like, it's 5 years later and all the cops died because they kept being, like, all just goofy.
Go to the edge of your imagination and jump. You know, like that's, like, kind of the point. So, and even, like, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love Star Trek and I'm probably going to get jumped all over, but, like, for saying this, but there are some things in Star Trek that really are just kind of, like, replicating the systems that we already have and, like, putting them in outer space. And I'm like, is that what we're doing? Is that, like, can we at least be critical of it? Like, so I'd really like to see, you know, people just, because I know that there's folks that are doing that kind of sci-fi writing, and it's like, get them in the room and have them, like, just literally redefine all of the tropes. We can do it. We're ready. Like, break our brains. It's fine. They're broken. We don't know what's going on now. So this is the right time for it. You know? So that's, like, really, like, broadly and more specifically, I would like to see more werewolf movies in general. Like, I want to see more werewolf movies and more werewolf stories and werewolf content. that centers women. I don't understand why every single werewolf story, I wrote one, by the way, because yes. I was like so angry about this. I don't understand why every single werewolf narrative centers men when that is the only creature that's tied to the lunar cycle. And I feel like it like writes itself. Like, I feel like it's almost like inherently sexy, like it's sexist. Like it's like clearly supposed to be a woman. Once a month, the person who is a werewolf, when the moon is where the moon needs to be, they become a beast, quote unquote, for a week. These are the trope. This is what people will say to you. Like, if you're making a point at work, they'll be like, oh, is that that time of the month? Like, I just feel like it's obviously a woman. All werewolves are women. Why do they star men at all? Like, that to me is the somehow even more sexist than something that is so generically female still somehow is about a dude. I'm just like, why are you in any of these movies? Like, clearly this is about women. Clearly.
When it does star women, they're the best ones. Like Ginger Snaps, right? It's like, it's the ones that like actually kind of explore that a little bit. You're just like, oh yes. Or I watched the movie Good Manners, I believe is the name of it. It's like a 3-hour long, and it's like the werewolf is like a little boy. Like the werewolf is not the woman, like the main character of the movie, but the main character of the movie is taking care of this little boy. And so it still is 100% her story.
Blood Moon. Have you seen Blood Moon?
I haven't. What is that?
Blood Moon is another werewolf story, and it is also about, it's like a woman on the, it's a woman on the run. She's on the run. It's great. Oh. It's really like bare knuckle, like white knuckle kind of type of film where it's not a lot of people. It's in a remote location because she's just like always like living off of the grid because she fell in love with a werewolf, had a baby, and the dad's dead, and now she's got to raise a werewolf.
Oh, wow. No, I haven't. I haven't heard of this. I'm going to watch it, though, because this sounds awesome. Yes, good. I have a subscription.
And this is another one where like it centers people of color, and that's like not what the point of the movie is at all. It's about a mom who has a baby that's a werewolf.
That's kind of Good Manners in a way, except for like, I guess where maybe it has commentary around it is how the people outside of it treat them.
Yeah, sure.
But other than that, it's like basically just like, it's just somebody who's just trying to get through her day. That is for sure. She's like, I got a werewolf kid. Baby. No, that's awesome. I'm going to check that one out. I haven't even seen it, but I think that you're totally onto something when it comes to werewolf stuff, because it's like, even when I remember in The Swamp Thing by Alan Moore era, there was a story of like a character who does turn into a werewolf, and it is very clearly linked to menstrual cycles. But also like it's written by a dude in it, so it doesn't fully land. Right. It's like of course, like I'm sure that a dude could write it well, maybe in like this era instead of like the early 80s or something where it's like talking about women at all was feminist. But like, I remember that story.
Look at how, applaud for me. I put a girl in this.
Yes. Well, and also just the fact that you're like, oh, this is a comic book talking about menstrual cycles.
Yeah,
like
you that said is menstrual.
Wild. Whoa. Yeah. So I think that that's about all I got. Like, this has been such a fun conversation. I like went way over time, but I'm so glad that we got to talk about this stuff because
female werewolves being inherently female is an important message that had to be delivered.
Xena being inherently gay and like the fact that we're kind of over dystopian shit because it's like always. Yeah, I don't know. I guess if we were going to be like as kind-hearted as possible, we'd be like, maybe The Handmaid's Tale was like an unself-aware kind of commentary on white feminism in a way. But like, it's also one of those things where you're just like, no, like sterilization happened. Like,
it's happening.
It is happening.
There's whistleblowing about it happening at the border.
Yeah.
Remember last year that woman was talking about that?
God.
Yeah, so I've never watched Handmaid, and you know, shout out to the author of that book, and I've heard about the book, and I actually kind of want to read the book.
You know, it's like, it's got its ups and downs.
Okay. But, you know, I haven't watched that show, and I know it's good, like.
It's hard to watch, though, too.
It's, you know, award-winning.
Yeah.
But a big part of the reason that I didn't watch that show is because I've read about slavery.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, I saw that show.
Yeah.
It's lived history.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I went to the museum. It was about it. So, like, I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
But I think...
And it's one of those, too, that's kind of, like, doesn't really address... Like, it addresses queer issues to an extent. Like, it doesn't talk about what this means for trans women, of course. But it does address... Like, there is a lesbian character who definitely suffers for being a lesbian, for sure. Like, she is treated very badly. And it's very specific to, like, what her situation is, for sure. So there's... It's like they... It's all of the time with... It's like that story, but then like the adaptations thereof, it's 100% one of those things where it's like they're always kind of teetering on self-awareness and you're kind of like, oh, they're gonna go further, oh no, we're just back to like some weird like Offred is like attracted to this guy but he works for the people who are bad or like yeah. whatever.
But I am really happy for shows like that because yeah. because you have to like crack the ice, you know what I'm saying? So
sure,
if we want to have the show that's this the space after that you need right. to have Handmaid it still. So like I don't know if you watch Motherland, Fort Salem.
Oh yeah. I'm just now getting into it.
Yeah,
so
I you know it's on Freeform, so it's just like this is not for my age demographic at all, but like sometimes exactly. I like to engage with, like, I watched Siren, their like mermaid show. I was like, yeah, let's do this. So I like to like dip a toe in that, and we watched the pilot thinking like, oh, we'll give it a whirl, why not, and then we got so into it, and now I'm like such a hardcore mother or Salem Motherland fan. But yeah. I just to make the connection of like, I don't think you could have a show like that without having Handmaiden first.
Sure.
You know yeah. what I'm saying? Like, now that one takes these ideas and starts to go past, right? Like they're taking it farther. That must be based on a book, because that world is so like, the culture of that whole alternate timeline is really amazing.
Yeah, as I'm getting into it, I'm like, this show is a lot more fun than I was expecting it to be.
Yeah, it's deeper than I thought. You know, like from the trailers, I was like, oh, this is just gonna be like some, like, I don't know, like they have powers and they can do things and we're young people and we're gorgeous, you know?
Yeah.
And then I got in on it and I was like, oh no, they're like treating this in the same way that you would a Game of Thrones, you know, in the sense that like,
right.
they don't explain anything to you. They just drop you into the middle of the action. And they're just like, you'll keep up. It'll be fine. And you really do have to like pay attention to understand like the rules of the world
mm-hmm.
and like this society and how this works and what, and where they are. Like the map at the beginning is like the US doesn't even look the same. I was like, oh, this is so much more than I thought it was going to be. Y'all are really pulling it out. Okay. And that one is a little more self-aware, I think, of yeah. the vagaries of white feminism. Like,
sure.
there are some times where they kind of like fall into it a little bit, and I'm kind of like, but that thing she did was super bad.
Sure.
There's
yeah.
a lot of times when they really like, they call it out.
None of us should have to really feel like we have to, because like I watch like old Buffy or something and I'm like, this is very offensive to lesbians. Like there's like always a bunch of stuff, but it's like also at the same time
there was lesbians in that writer's room, I don't think.
I don't think so, but like I would put money on it for sure. Yeah, it's like it's one of those things where it meant so much to so many people, and like people yeah. it's like not none of us are like Buffy, like, right? Like, none of us are like her. Like, it's like we maybe have personality traits, but like, I wasn't into cheerleading. I wasn't into like,
yeah.
you know, any of this stuff. And Buffy always had her shit together, like, quite a bit. And then it's like later you see something like Winona Earp, where it's like the older Buffy who like completely is like traumatized, you know, yeah. and like dealing with like all of this like fallout, which makes for an interesting show. And it's definitely one of those things, yeah, where it's like, it's like as much as I am always like complicated feelings around Buffy, I'm also just like, thank God that show existed
yeah.
because like, I mean, there's problems every episode, but like Xander existing, right, is like one of those things where I'm like, I'm gonna write to the network. Oh, it ended years ago. But like, it's definitely one of those things where it's like, this guy is kind of an incel.
But at the same time, he's an incel that like doesn't become a lone shooter. And I feel
yes.
like that's like an important thing to yeah. see and witness, especially in the 90s when the Columbine, that's like when that happened. that was like the beginning of that movement, if you want to call it, or that community. So it's like,
sure,
please watch Xander and how he processes this without becoming violent.
Far be it for me to give props to Xander, but like, I will say there's a very clear line once they start to bring in the incel crew, right? Like those dudes who kill Tara eventually.
Yeah.
There's that very clear line between what Xander is willing to put up with in life or like what he'll do. You're still like, this guy is questionable as hell. Like he definitely like slut shames Buffy and is just like a weird dude sometimes. Mm-hmm. But then you're also like, he also sees what they do and he's like, fuck absolutely that. Not. Like, absolutely yeah. not. And that's there's like what... Yeah, it's like, that's what we want, you know, is like, even if somebody is like, really kind of insufferable at times, it's like, you still have to see the difference between that and like, and somebody who is like,
girlfriend.
Yeah, 100%.
Now we're going off on another tangent again. I know you have to, this thing has to end. I'm so sorry.
Yes.
Gentle listeners, just go with us. Come with us on this ride.
Like, yes.
You know, that him doing that and also just within the trio, like that dynamic of Warren really being like super incel and Jonathan being like,
right,
no, this is your girlfriend. You know, this woman, this is wrong. Yeah. You didn't tell us that this was like him being like, oh, wait a minute. No, that this is rape. And I love that the way that dynamic between the three of them was written. Actually, because there were moments of self-awareness. They were complicated. And, you know, Warren at the end ended up was like, you can like squarely say like he's the bad guy. But there was like, you could see the things escalate. You could see them like start from a place of just like, we just have this power. We just want to make her do whatever we want. And then like it gets like worse and worse and worse and worse. And also for Xander, I really love that he always disliked Spike.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
That never changed. He never didn't not like Spike. I also kind of like that he never really liked Angel. And right. That never changed. Like, he always was like, whatever. Like, and maybe it was because he was kind of in love with Buffy, but I do think there's a message in there about the behavior of those two men that Xander was like, that is wrong.
Right.
You guys are yeah. mooning over them because they're good-looking dudes, but they are, in fact, violent and dangerous and kind and also like sexist in their own right.
Like yeah. and truly evil, right? Like yeah, I mean even once they are good, like they still like, you know, that's like a real shaky foundation.
Yeah, so like, I dig that he never came around and that they left, that they wrote it like that, where Xander like never was like convinced about those two men, and though he's a flawed man,
yeah,
but his voice of dissent always kind of had kept me looking at the two of them like, yeah, like before Angel goes, and this is just like getting into the gender politics of it, like, you know, before Angel goes evil, just him always lurking around and watching
yes.
her, watching her sleep and like
yeah.
being kind of inappropriately paternal.
Yep.
For and sure. like, I feel like if Xander wasn't there being like saying little snide remarks, I wouldn't have been so keen on that. I might have like fallen into like, Angel's like really sexy, but because
yeah,
he's there
pretty.
I was like yeah, why does he watch her when he, that is creepy.
And he just in general, he, even at his like, he's supposed to be a vampire who's super old, and it's like, yeah, but even in real life he's like 35, right? Like he's like kind of an older dude, so you're just like,
yeah,
him hanging
doing?
out.
Yeah, and she's the chosen one, and you want to like keep talking down to her about how you have to keep her safe, but like, she's the chosen one. Like, who are
she's
you?
She's straight up the chosen one, yeah.
And then, like, you know, the same thing with Spike, just being obsessed. And obviously then also being he assaulted her. Like,
yeah.
You know?
With, like, the group of incels or whatever, that was right before, you know, we started seeing, like, all of those doxing attacks
yeah.
and, like, all of this stuff
yeah.
that was, like, so in a weird way, prescient. But you know what?
But that's like a whole other thing. I mean, we could go on and on. I think the point is that like this genre allows you to do that, and it allows you to like talk about these things in a way that feels kind of safe. Like, we didn't really
yeah.
get into like the actual, like, R. Kelly is finally being charged. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we don't
right.
have to like talk about, I'm not that we can't, but it does smooth that transition or smooth, it just makes it somehow easier to get into talking about these things if you get to do it through this like filter.
Yes. Okay. This was great. I loved talking to you because clearly this went for at least twice as long as I thought.
A bunch of this, but maybe our tangents.
we're gonna see how it goes because maybe this can just be two different things because literally we talk so much about 90s TV that it's almost its own episode at this point.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @BitchesOnComics and on Instagram at @BitchesOnComics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com or on Twitter at @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.